Thank you, Susan. Thank you, Stephen. Thank you, Tokwase, for inviting me and trusting me to hold a conversation with you. Thank you all for being here. I imagine everyone has had a chance to go and look at the exhibition and the works that are in it. Wonderful. And there is a very beautiful catalog booklet that has been produced for it as well, and I hope that you all took one. Thank you, Tokwase, for sharing the poetry. This is an aspect of your practice that I did not know about yet. And the language, the words that you shared are as many keys or portals or passageways into aspects of the practice. But what I want to do to begin is actually just very simply think about where we are right now and just a few dimensions of the making of work in a place that come up almost generically as a way to kind of think about getting into some of the ideas in the work. And the first is your work has always operated at multiple scales with many meanings attached to the word scale, but certainly size and format. Probably if we trace the curve, the average, they're getting larger and larger, more and more architectural, more and closer to what we might call habitability. And in so doing, they move, I think, from this sort of annoying art term of site specificity, right, site-specific work, to actually having a kind of relation with their environment that goes beyond the idea of, like, specificity, right? Which is all to say, when you receive the invitation to make work here, in that building, in this space, in this landscape, in this terrain and territory, what were some of the stages of kind of processing and absorbing all of that to then inform the kind of work that you wanted to place in the space?
That's a good question. I think Susan would agree with me, where we went through several iterations of what I might do and how I might do that. So it was a conundrum, to say the least. But I found myself when thinking about different ways and different titles and different projects, I found myself in Bird and Lava because of what just happened in St. Louis. And while I'm trying to figure out what I was going to do in T-Space, this larger project in St. Louis, I was studying St. Louis as a terrain. I was studying Scott Joplin as a human being, activist, inventor, and magician. And so I needed to work out that shape language of Bird and Lava a bit more and continue thinking about scale. So the text Bird and Lava, which is in the book, came from a small poem that I had written for something I can't remember, but something about that bird and lava language, the height movement of a bird in relationship to the form condition of lava, had me think about this sort of multiscalar condition of being, and I wanted to work it out here now. So because T-Space was in front of me, I sort of went back into that, and I visited the site again. And I thought about, okay, what does it mean to be in this sort of hyper rectilinear space with these lights that are coming in from the west, and think about how to create something autonomous. So I began to take apart the shapes of Bird and Lava and think about architecture of the space, and how could I fit in, meet it where it is in its beauty and its sort of poetic. So I just sort of siloed myself in the space and drew myself to that sculpture, and then brought in the pieces up top later. So it was, I draw myself to these things often, but that's how it sort of ended up. And the drawing came, and I took apart the drawing, and then the pieces came, and then it worked out, I think.
What about this broader ecological and geological and socio-cultural terrain of the Hudson Valley, where we are now and where you have your own studio in another town in the area, and have been for a medium period of time now, right? And working in this land, in this terrain.
So I moved to Beacon during COVID. And what it allowed me is to set myself in the bottom of a mountain, right? So quite literally, I opened the door of my studio. There's a mountain. And as you know, I grew up in Chicago. So I was quickly reminded that, you know, I grew up by a lake and now I'm growing by a mountain. So I sort of, I leaned into the idea of my small self in that large ongoing form. And thought about, of course, the idea of slowness, right, and mountains, and that grew me to, you know, human geography and Rob Dixon's Slow Violence, and what does it mean to be in the space of dispossession and make work here, feeling like a new person in this new region of New York, where we drive up and there it's extremely a community of white right wing flags everywhere. That was strange. So, and then there's this other community of poets and writers and people who try not to make violence. So it's an ecosystem that I'm trying to figure out. These highways and remind me of North Carolina sometimes, you know, which brings me back to silence and birds. So in a larger sort of phenomenological way, I think about the ancestorships that were here, you know, before colonization. And in a smaller way, I think about my own meditative space. And I just try to focus in on the studio. But I'm learning this valley that has been named Hudson, which is in part very violent in itself. But I'm just trying to meet somewhere where I can be calm and make my work.
You mentioned the project in St. Louis, which is part of a kind of a triennial, or they call themselves a civic exhibition called Counterpublic, which is up now through mid-July. And your work there is a very large work in terms of its mass and volume, that is in the middle of kind of a open plaza park area on the north side of St. Louis, and where it's built in such a way that it's very inviting to walk in and be in it and experience its shapes, which I don't want to over-describe them because anybody should find what their own illusions are, but there it's definitely set up so that one can be in it, sit in it, and it has musicality, right? It has a soundtrack that is adapted and adjusted from Scott Joplin Ragtime, which is St. Louis. You also have, is Desert X still up? It came down, right? Desert X, just recently, those who were in California, in Southern California, you had work in Desert X. So, you know, here we are in the Hudson Valley. That's St. Louis, the north side of St. Louis, kind of disinvested American urban red brick, et cetera, environment. Desert X, for those of you who may have been to previous iterations of that show, is the desert, is the Mojave. And so you're working, and these are just three that are, you know, you're going to Liverpool tomorrow, Liverpool, England, tonight, right? Where you're going to have work in the Liverpool Biennial. Can we say the thing that's happening in the fall? Brazil, can we talk about that?
Sure.
Yeah, and you're going to São Paulo. So there's a lot going on. Your practice is in a very kind of visible and active state in terms of what people can see from the outside, but it's also working across all of these different spaces and ecosystems and ecologies and histories. What's the common thread in apprehending all of those and in working on those, and just also with the exigencies of how the work process goes, often having to think about several of them at the same time?
Fundamentally, I found myself trying to make sure that the research process, particularly in Sao Paulo, Bahia, and at the, like, I'm also making something in South Korea, particularly in these kinds of conditions where I am an other, and there's also a Black diaspora there, and there's a condition of colonization and dispossession there. What I found myself is fighting against, continuously fighting against the idea of universality, but understanding that the common thread, if people want to be free and breathe clean air, and people want to connect with their own built environments and have autonomy in those built environments. So there's always this discursive condition that's happening that really debunks everything that this sort of hyper-fast condition of the modern acceleration idea has, right? So what it means to move through these places as an artist and as a person who is talking and thinking about these geographies at the same time is, of course, I lean back on Hortense Spillers and, like, yes, there must be a new demography. We have to create a new condition of science that is related to imagination, that is related to built environments, but also how do we think about imagine a new biosphere that is connected to, you know, quite to shorthand ancient traditions, you know? So those are the things where I'm pulling these things together, and Bird and Lava as a sort of structure helps me remind myself that everything has to have a multiscalar approach, that nothing can be sort of duplicated and nothing is without a kind of plurality. So architecture is a really useful tool, as is abstraction, to allow me to think about interiority, movement, distance, scale, justice, and the history of people making justice for themselves. So that's just everywhere, you know.
This question of abstraction, you know, you use the term, and you know, some people will look at your work, oh, that's abstract, that's abstracting. What are the kind of lineages of that idea of abstraction that you feel your own kinship with, and are there others that you sort of push against?
That's a good question. Well, Martin Perrier was here earlier today, and the reason why I'm interested in that his work in particular is because he thinks about translation. So the way I am interested in sort of learning from him, his drawings, his paintings, his prints. Is how does he take these histories and translate them into something that I can feel inside my body, right? How do I think about form making in the way of narrative and storytelling in these traditions? So if there's some kind of fiction or poem or a quite didactic literal text, and I need to become closer to it, I need to understand that history spatially. Martin is very good at sort of making work that gets him closer to a truth and an imagination. So I'm interested in that sort of path. Pushing against. What I think in terms of pushing against, and I want to make sure we have time for the musicians, but I'll just say pushing against the idea that geometric abstraction has brought with it, or ideas of the minimal has, you know, the meaning has sort of been drained out of it, right? And there's a difference between the minimal and the distilled to get at something else. So I'm interested in deep distillation by way of meaning, by way of decolonizing something, and then moving on to something else. So I think I'm adding and pushing against hard edge abstraction and its separation from sort of an expressionistic mark. So those two things together, geometric abstraction and the history of abstract expressionism, I think that those things are indelibly tied. And I enjoy the idea of being able to use those things as and couple them so I can get closer to understanding how people live in built spaces and have world building in the future in my mind for the best possible condition for liberation or solving or working to through a long emancipation.
Mm-hmm. Long emancipation, very important term. That's a reference. Rinaldo Walcott, right?
Who I was just in conversation with a few days ago. But yeah, the way we talk, right. Where he talks about it.
Will you give me a signal of like time-wise?
Very interesting.
Yeah. I feel like we have some time, right? Yeah.
Let's do another
15 or okay. And then will you be up for a couple of things from the audience or would you like to just keep it? Okay. One thing that I find beautiful and that one of the things that I resonate with in your practice is the balance or the interplay that exists in it between intention, design, right, as we might think in thinking as the work becomes more and more architectural, this idea of design that goes into it, but actually improvisation and decisions that are made in the moment. I've been around you at times when work is, you know, in those stages where maybe it's finished or maybe it's not finished, something is happening in the absolute moment. It looks great. But I wonder if you could talk a little bit about improvisation, because that's also the condition of daily life, right? And you were talking about people living and finding better ways to live in the world, and even liberation is both by design and by improvisation and exigency, right? And even, you know, this is apparent in music, in certain musical traditions. How much do you think, you know, people see some of these works that you make and they seem so precise, technical, calculated even in the best meaning of that term. But you're also an improviser, right?
Yes, well, I practice towards improvisation, Cecil Taylor, right? So I have a set of rules and a set of sort of assignments I give myself to set up for type of improvisation that is acutely aware that I'm trying to exhaust the possibility of the moment, right? So what does it mean to be mentally in a here and now space and not think about the future, not think about the past, but really empty one's mind out to make a mark or make an action? Well, to do that in a sort of way that I would like to think about as precise is I have to make drawings every day, right? I have to cut, make shape language, look at images. So I practice for these moments where I then fall into an improvisational condition or I set myself up for improvisational condition that then allows this other technique and forms to sort of come out, right? So a lot of the shape languages in Bird and Lava come out of a drawing practice where I give myself sort of a minute to make a shape. Or this is a Tony Smith practice where I try to make a curvilinear condition inside a rectilinear condition. And so to really, in the tradition of the Tuareg women, so you have to bend these shapes, these shapes to create an interior or habitable form in like 50 seconds, right? So what can I learn from West African modular women architects and engineers? And what can I learn from, you know, Tony Smith's drawings? Or what can I learn from my own teachings and working in Mississippi? Like, how do I tap into that rigor and then set out to make a thing? And then when I'm in front of a painting, it's all a mess, you know, but that's where, you know, it gets good. The mess is, again, Cecil Taylor. You get into that mess and you just lean into it. And with the architectural space, it's like, you know, gravity is nerve wracking. You know, that's what
it's
I
a
learned
problem
about
sometimes,
architecture.
Yeah.
Gravity is like what I want to do, but then there's the gravity condition. So then I find myself, okay, so how do I engineer this condition, right? So engineering puts a real poetic spin on improvisation. So I just find that tension really helpful between the drawings and the paintings and the more architectural things. So
I'd
follow the women, you know.
I'd like to move us as we evolve the conversation. I'd like to move us towards liberation explicitly, or at least move this conversation towards liberation, or the topics towards liberation explicitly, and that means we get to this concept of Black compositional thought, Right, which animates, which you have iterated and deepened over quite a long time now. And I wonder if, by way of explicating what Black compositional thought means, we could focus in on who is the composer and what is the composing that is taking place.
Thank you for that question. So it was, I need a structure, right, to work inside within my now practice. And Black compositional thought was a theory that I've been developing by way of thinking of pure perception and the ways in which being under the rubric of the transatlantic slave trade and under the rubric of the plantational scene, of plantation logics, and under the rubric of a built environment that was meant to dispossess and make material the body. So in all of these enclosures, how do people get free? Well, they don't get free by people looking at them. They get free by looking out into space, right? And having to, under the worst conditions, your eyes have to function, your lungs have to function, your mind has to function. You have to have some perceptual genius to free yourself from people who live off your death, right? So Black compositional thought is, for me, is an argument that Black perceptual movement in ways of being, in networks of freedom, operating simultaneously, is a subject that needs to be attended through the visual arts. So my work is to attend to perception, light, distance, scale, because I am sure that as climates change, and as people of color, people in the global south, people who are, I'll say, vulnerable to the way environmental catastrophe is coming, we're going to need some of that knowledge, right? We're going to need to figure out how to think perceptually about different scales of space, right? And how do we not only think about that space, how do we organize with each other to then conquer space and make new space, right? So within the history of Black liberation practices, and you know, I sort of anchor myself in Box Brown, Harriet Jacobs, and Tony. So all of these self-liberators had to deal with air, closed space, large space, distances. But what is helpful for me is one made in architecture, one found in architecture, and one reused in architecture.
I wonder if we could just pause to develop each of those real quick, just for those who may be unfamiliar with them, because this is kind of like the atomic structure of the geometry, right? And how certain forms recur. They are not the sole forms, but they are the structuring forms, both materially and also kind of ideas wise. I don't know if you'd like to develop just one or two of them, just so people understand how the work geometrizes itself.
Yeah. So Harriet Jacobs was a woman who was enslaved, and to flee her plantation life and fear of rape by her owner, she hid in her mother's garret for supposedly 8 years, right? So in this garret, which is a irregular triangle, to think about it through the seasons in these 8 years, winter, spring, summer, and fall. Winter, she didn't hear her children outside. She was alone. She felt lonelier in that space, right? Summer, she burrowed a hole in this architectural space to get air and circulation going. Over that period of time, her anatomy changed over time. Box Brown, of course, with a friend, built this box, shipped himself, ended up in Canada. But what was so interesting about this very long story is he reused this box for performances. He became an enslaved person, became self-made himself into a magician, essentially. So he would paint these southern landscapes inside this box when he made it to Canada. He would open this box and perform and tell stories about his journey from
Virginia
to Canada. So imagine these kinds of conditions over and over again, but the rectilinear or that curvilinear shape, the curvilinear shape is, of course, from, Tony Burns, who, what was so diabolical about the infrastructure of slavery is one of them was, of course, when the institutions understood that people insist on liberation, they kept creating these laws that would then make it almost impossible for people to help the enslaved who were trying to run away. And one of those laws were the fugitive law. So under the fugitive codes, Tony was, of course, trying to escape over and over again from Charlotte to
Virginia to Boston, I think.
He got sent back and did it again. So this is a man who hid in the hull of a ship several times trying to self-liberate. So that curvilinear condition of being in the hold is what I talk about, the hole in the hold. And the irregular triangle, which a lot of that comes out of the, arrives at the trapezoid. And then the rectilinear shape that comes from box. And, you know, this is this sort of alphabet that then I comes out in these multiple formulations. So I set myself, this is a piece of improvisation, I gave myself a sort of rule to work with these geometries. And what informs that rule can be anything. Sharjah informed that rule, right? Scott Joplin and syncopation informed that rule. But the discipline of the rule is that I give myself a time, I give myself a scale, I give myself, but that's the sort of foundational structure. Because all of that condition is Black compositional thought. And that is, for me, the key to thinking about where, for me, abstraction and as an art form, because we're the project of perception is an unfinished project.
And so when Box composes himself into the space as he finds it, he's also composing the space, right? And when Harriet Jacobs is composing herself, even literally like becoming composed in order to compose, she is then also, she's working from space, but she's also composing the space. And I think that
also one of the things of liberators, even on an auction block, right, thinking about how people think about those who are trying to purchase them from that singular architectural form, right? How do you compose yourself inside an architecture while you're being dispossessed? And how does liberation happen? Composing your voice to shout out, no, Master Charlie, I don't want you to buy me. Or no, sir, I heard about you. You know, these kinds of, from language to space and looking out and being able to assess not only your slavers and not only the auctioneer, but also the geography that's in front of you, right? So there's no need for me to make an image of a body on an auction block. The work is to really understand what thought, composition, spatial conditions were happening, and how do I get closer into understanding that condition of being when everything about that institution said the mind was a non-entity, a non-condition. Senses, sensory, sensoria was a non-condition. Right? So, yeah, composing, compositional thought has to do, besides that rubric of shapes, it has to do with the brain. It has to do with the mind, like how that gray matter works.
And one of the liberations, I think, that's taking place here is that from our perspectives in theory or in ideology or in aesthetics or in all these different kinds of fields in which we are trained or self-trained or steeped, or the language of the work around us takes place, this kind of abstraction, this kind of reading of space and of building and of line is also an unlearning that brings us to what would otherwise have been called, you know, the vernacular, the daily life, right? Of how people are adjusting and operating and surviving and getting ahead or so on, or dealing, right? In daily life. And I think that it's some of the real particular genius of your work is how it invites us to unlearn as much as to study the, in many ways, kind of complexity of the pieces that you make. And I hope that some of these ideas are then ones that people can go back and think about, look again at the work, look again at the large sculpted object, think about the apertures, think about the other things that are going on in it. Start with that vocabulary that we talked about and then see what else is going, but then also see how it works in the smaller pieces, in the works that are painterly or drawing-like in scale and in their kind of formality, but also sculptural. And when we talked about Liverpool, for example, I remember a conversation that we had about the research trip that you took to Liverpool, and how it took actually going on a tour, you know, with a young black tour guide in Liverpool who could point out certain things to you about the history of the place, to then have realizations that became geometric and that then became connective to other things in your life, your way of looking. And I'm not going to invite you to restate that now in the interest of just kind of moving forward, but it's just a little bookmark that I'd like to put in case it comes up again in conversation. But where I wanted to go to kind of bring it all together is that in this kind of high-low of, like, here we are in the high arts and rarefied space, but we're also talking about interpreting and unlearning ourselves into the condition of daily life. Some of the people with whom you've been thinking with for many years, right? You come out of the black liberation tradition, black liberation politics, and your background in Chicago and so on. And then you also think with some of the most extraordinary black feminist thinkers that we have right now, and even that term isn't enough to contain what people like Professor Sadie Hartman, Professor Christina Sharp, and so on are doing. And so I wonder how you, with your connections to the land and the ground, you've driven around the Deep South, doing, you know, you've gotten dirty there in the mud, as AJ would say, you know, like all of that, and then with this kind of theoretical apparatus and thinking luxuries that you have of being in companionship with these political traditions, these feminist traditions, and so forth. What's the way together for you in terms of the daily practice of merging it all together so that we actually do move closer to liberation?
Okay, I'm going to finish this.
Exactly. We're building up to it.
Yeah, I think that the work is really about assessing what we need as a collective, right? So the field work, the moving around the South with black women geographers, black women performance ethnographers, with poets and writers and musicians, it's being out in the world, right? And then develop, and the theory comes out of trying to figure out the unknown and unasked as of yet. So I think that the sort of everydayness of driving through Mississippi or North Carolina and the making of the artwork is tied to trying to figure out what happened to us.
Mm-hmm. Do we want to invite one or two perspectives from the room, or do you want to go straight to? It's really your.
What's going on? Is it raining out there?
Just starting up.
So how do you feel about? Because we're about ready to start the music in a minute.
Move it a little bit? Yeah. So should we just interact for a moment or two, or should we take a break? I feel like it would be nice to like invite just one or two quick responses from the room, because I feel like there's a lot of genius, there's a lot of collective genius in the space here, and we would be shortchanging ourselves not to get a little sampler of it. Yeah.
I want to be very polemical, and I want to say something about Carl Andre. One time in London, I was there, and he said every steel square on this floor.
Carl Andre's piece in London when I was there in 1976, and he made this statement, something like, every square piece of steel on this floor stands for a child that was killed in Vietnam. My question is, this means that. It's abstraction. Does Carl Andre's statement have validity? I mean, I like Carl, but he had a very troubled life. We all know the trouble of Carl Andre.
I have a really deep refusal to that question. A real deep refusal to that question. I think that's my response.
Perspectives? Questions? Yeah, Raphael?
You were talking about traveling through the South. I was wondering, you were talking about the two of you traveling through the South recently. I was wondering if you have a report from...
We've separately traveled through the South.
if you have some information that you can report to us of...
I'll say one thing. I was in the Deep South for the last month, and some of you may not be surprised to know, or may know yourself from your own firsthand experience, that some of the places in the United States where the conditions of oppression have been strongest and fiercest for the longest period of time are also, by a very understandable dialectics, the places where the traditions of resistance and liberation are the strongest, and continue to be. And I was at an art world event in a museum in New York City a couple days ago. I happened to be wearing a t-shirt that said Jackson, Mississippi on it. And someone at the end of the event said, acquaintance said, Jackson, Mississippi, Jackson, what is that? And I was like, it's a city in Mississippi, it's the capital of Mississippi. And they were like, yes, I know, but. They were asking what the concept was of the t-shirt, and I'm like, I'm just representing Jackson. It's a very fascinating, beautiful place. Really? How? The conversation didn't really go much further than that, but the point is, the land is out there, and the work is happening. And we shouldn't even fetishize the South. Yes, there's a political formation, and the Confederacy was a particular formation, and so on. But we shouldn't even fetishize it. The work is happening. The work is out there. The work is in the Midwest. The work is in Pittsburgh. The work is in Omaha. The work is happening. And any time that we close ourselves to going and seeing and finding the work on its terms, where it is, in the places where it is, we're really shortchanging ourselves, I think.
Hi, I just have a quick question. You were referencing all these different places like Chicago and St. Louis, and I was just curious what the role of like memory and psychogeography plays into your practice, and how these places that you've inhabited play into your work now as like a nostalgia or like reminiscence.
Yeah, I think that, and this is really true, and it's such a cliche, but it is art as a way of knowing, right? So before I found myself as an artist, I just couldn't understand or comprehend things. Things would not stick. I couldn't understand what was going on. So when I found art and making and painting and drawing and sculpture, I could figure out Chicago. You know, now architecture, now I can really figure out Chicago. And I can figure out geography and I can figure out geology because I use art as a way to understand what's, that's just the way my mind works. And so I think what memory plays in, because I went to Tougaloo College in Tougaloo, Mississippi, and I identify as a Tougalooan. And I started painting at Tougaloo, and Tougaloo was an ex-enslaved person's plantation, right? So, and I say it that way because I'm having problems saying that I was learned. I learned how to paint on a plantation, on an ex-plantation. So anyway, that helps me understand that I am just at the tip of what I need to be concerned with. So I'm now rereading From Slavery to Freedom. I'm rereading Dion Brand's mapping, The Door of No Return. So everything I thought I knew, I need to know again as a 50-year-old woman. So I'm relooking at things. So things are this sort of, and I understand now I'm not in the ecosphere, I'm in a biosphere. So I'm now learning how to work really hardcore in this discursive condition. So I say yes to South Korea and understand what kinds of quotidian liberation practices were happening there. And I can go to Sao Paulo and make my way to, Salvador, and then make my way to understanding, you know, the history of colonial architecture in its specifics, you know. So all of these, all of this research, I need to get myself in the ocean to understand liquidity. You know, I didn't understand oil extraction until I got myself in the Gulf of Mexico and understood what the fuck extraction points were. So I don't, it's a mix of all of that, but your body, you know, your body is a learned place. And thank God that art is a thing that I can do to help me understand how all of these things are networked together. And thank God that I understand there is a pre-colonial condition. There is a space where race was created, and that was on the European continent when they were killing each other. So this all of this back moving, and then how to, you know, race became a capital condition, and then it became, so now I can say, oh, okay, you out there racing, you know, that's not, you got to deal with your, you know, so I can now refuse things and I can take things in, but art is the way I do that. And movement is the way I understand how important someone like Box Brown, like how the fuck, you know, the people migrate, you know, it's just, but now I understand how that happens everywhere, all the time. But that's the answer to your question. It's all the time, everywhere, all mixed up together, being open, being nobody when I need to be absolutely nobody, that works for me too, and listening, deep listening, and having conversations and saying, yep, yep, when you know Jackson, Mississippi, you know, Tougaloo College. Represent Tougaloo Eagle Queen. So that's where I'm at.
So on that note, I just want to thank you for the brilliance and inspirational force of your work, your scales, your words, your scales in all the senses of the term, and for the truly beautiful challenge that you share with us to at once learn and unlearn at the same time. So thank you, and let's take a break and on to the music.
Thank you.